Yesterday, Microsoft began selling a new version of its Office software, and notably, it allows users to store documents on the web rather than on their personal computers. This new feature is seen as an attempt to fend off Google, which has been encroaching on Microsoft territory with software that's free and based on the web. With the move, Microsoft is going further into, or onto, whichever you choose, the cloud. That's cloud computing, a trend that is rapidly transforming the way we work in the office and at home. To find out more, we turn to Wilson Rothman. He's the features editor for the technology blog Gizmodo.com. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Can we begin with a definition of cloud computing?
Well, it's a slippery one, but the safest way to define it would be to say that cloud computing is the computing that happens on the internet rather than on your computer. A good example would be back in the day when we wanted to get on AOL, we had to load a bunch of software onto our computers. Now when we want to get on Facebook, we just open a web browser and Facebook is there. That's the computer versus the cloud right there.
Is there a place that the cloud in a way is located?
Well, the cloud physically is a bunch of servers in a bunch of warehouses all over the world. That's the cloud. Now, obviously, what it really means is it's computers doing the software handling that we used to do on our own personal computers.
When one's personal data, if it's not inside your own computer, it seems that you're somewhat at the mercy of whatever cloud computing service you're using to safeguard your privacy and even the security of that information.
Absolutely. But the flip side is they're better at keeping your data than you are. People at home lose data all the time. I was shocked the other day. I heard a statistic that 5% of Americans use an extra hard drive to back up their computer. And hard drives die all the time. I had one die last Friday.
Yeah, even the best companies can't stop hackers. And the most high-profile hacking that we've heard about lately was probably with Google. It had some of its software code stolen.
Right.
And later said what was stolen was a code to the company's global password system. Now, that didn't mean that anyone was hurt, but doesn't it suggest what could happen?
You know, I think the best analogy for that is that there's a difference between stealing the blueprints to the castle and the keys to the castle. You can look at a blueprint till your head spins. You still might not be able to figure out a way in. And as far as I know, user passwords were not stolen. That would be the bad thing.
Although, do hackers not, you know, use everything they can? And aren't they sometimes quite good at finding weak points in a system?
Yeah, this is why there's obviously a large part of the software community dedicated to security. This is a big deal. But I would say that a company like Google or even a company like Facebook, they're not going to mess around when they build their entire business on consumer trust.
Well, since increasingly cloud computing is transforming the way we put data on computers, whether at work or at home, do you have tips on, you know, sort of what to do and what to avoid?
Absolutely. The key to this whole thing is the password. I dug up some numbers that are kind of startling. A hacker can use software to decode a 4-character password in 1.5 minutes. But if the password is 8 characters, it would take 2 centuries.
Huh.
Those extra 4 characters geometrically expand the difficulty of decrypting the password to a degree that the hacker wouldn't even bother.
Wilson Rothman writes for the technology blog Gizmodo.com. Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you.
If you've listened to pop music over the past 40 years, you've heard more than a few songs with a robotic sound. You might have even wondered how that effect was created. Well, it didn't happen in a music studio. It all began at the phone company.
This is the voice of power. I make it possible for you to have electric light and radio and television. I am both your servant and your master, so beware of how you use me.
That otherworldly voice was recorded in the 1930s by Bell Labs, the research division of AT&T. That strange sound was made by speaking into one of their newest inventions, a vocoder. Originally developed to reduce the cost of long distance, the vocoder has had many uses over the years. Dave Tompkins has written a new book about the device, How to Wreck a Nice Speech, The Vocoder from World War II to Hip-Hop. He says the vocoder played a significant role in the Second World War.
Churchill and FDR's conversations were being intercepted by German intelligence and deciphered in real time. Pearl Harbor really cemented that idea because the warning and the Japanese ultimatum could not be transmitted by phone because the phones could not be trusted. They were looking for a different way to encode speech. And so Bell Labs was commissioned by the National Defense Research Committee in 1942 to develop this massive speech encoding machine.
Was there ever any trouble understanding what people were saying? Obviously, with this technology, you can really distort words and distort what's being said.
Intelligibility was a problem, in particular with the pitch control. They'd send Bell Labs engineers to the Pentagon to regulate this wild pitch situation. And so they didn't mind world leaders and generals sounding like robots just as long as they didn't sound like chipmunks. Eisenhower did not want to sound like a chipmunk.
All right. At some point, the vocoder made a shift from being something the military used to becoming part of popular culture. When did that begin to happen?
A big shift occurred in Germany, and there's a speech in 1949 by an information theorist named Werner Meyer Eppler, and he talked about the applications of artificial speech. And this speech inspired radio engineers in West Germany to have a vocoder developed by Siemens for West German radio in Cologne. But a big transitional point would be Wendy Carlos's soundtrack for A Clockwork Orange. Wendy Carlos did a vocoder interpolation of the fourth movement of Beethoven's Ninth, and essentially that introduced the vocoder to its first major audience. There were a lot of people who had no idea what it was, but as the vocoder evolved, they knew the voice, they just had no idea where it came from.
So after that voice was heard in A Clockwork Orange, did other musicians then sort of wonder what it was and begin experimenting with it?
It started appearing in music studios because the technology was still really expensive at the time. But German electronic musicians Kraftwerk from Dusseldorf were some of the first to make the vocoder more accessible through their early work. The first big hit would be Autobahn. This sort of serene journey across the highways. And the vocoder, it would just say Autobahn. this sort of gasp. And they continued to use it in their music for We Are the Robots and The Man Machine. And it sounded perfectly natural in the context of Kraftwerk because they were doing purely electronic music. You're charging power, get your aim.
You know, it seems to me that from what you're saying, the use of the vocoder started with experimental music, maybe avant-garde music, but then eventually it moved into mainstream with hip-hop, right?
It became the voice of electro-funk hip-hop in the early 80s. In particular, Michael Johnson, he's a disco musician from Boston, recorded perhaps the first entire hip-hop vocoder album, Lost in Space, which was released in 1983. And the song called Pac Jam was inspired by his intent to destroy all Pac-Man or Pac-Man machines because the video game made him dizzy. Futuristic sounds with the new synthesizer technology at the time, it really affected how people moved.
And also it has a successor, which is known as Auto-Tune. What is the connection between the vocoder and Auto-Tune?
Well, Auto-Tune is a pitch corrective software implant. It places the pitch in the right place on the musical scale. The vocoder breaks the voice down and then reconstructs it so that you have an input for speech and you have an input for a modulator, say a synthesizer, and you can play those notes through your voice. Auto-tune is often mistaken for vocoder, so in a sense, Auto-tune brought the vocoder back in vogue. But the Auto-tune sound is this sort of has this bird-like delirium to it that really appeals to pop. Like me, I'm about to a train.
So some might argue that this robotic sound is overused. Do you think that ultimately the vocoder was good for music?
Oh, certainly, certainly. I think expanded music in terms of the synthesizer technologies that were available at the time. And what's more human than wanting to inhabit a different character? And so I think it gave artists a sort of an outlet, became an escapism, especially with hip-hop in the early 1980s.
Dave Tompkins is a music journalist and author of How to Wreck a Nice Beach, The Vocoder, from World War II to hip-hop. Thanks. It was good talking to you, Dave.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And you can read an excerpt from Tompkins' book and hear songs featuring the vocoder at nprmusic.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary.
And I'm Renee Monte.
Social networking sites are more than a time saver or a tool. For many people, they are a way of life. It seems like every day there's a new site where people can post pictures and chat or follow their friends. And the number of users is growing as well. The world's largest social network, Facebook, estimates that it has 400 million active users. But a recent security glitch, exposing some private information about its users, has left people wondering just how secure their privacy is on the web. Joining us to talk about that is technology commentator Mario Armstrong. He hosts a technology talk program, Digital Cafe, on NPR member station WYPR. Welcome back, Mario.
Thanks, Allison. Thanks for having me in.
So what is going on with Facebook? They have this whole loophole. They were putting people's private stuff out in the street. What was exposed, and have they fixed it?
To answer the question, they moved on it right away and did fix it. But the problem was private chats between individuals were exposed to many people just to complete strangers. So that was the loophole.
Cute.
So no, not at all. I mean, if you and I were having a private chat, we would expect that information to be private, not to be shared with others that could see that information.
And didn't they just did something else where it opened up things like your birth date and your hometown and your photos and your friend list to everyone as some other sort of new policy? I mean, what's going on over there?
So here's the issue. They had a developers conference, and they make all of these announcements and changes and modifications to the site. And one of those changes was manipulating and moving around your privacy settings and adjusting some of these settings to reveal a little bit more information. Most of this, I believe, is targeted to help them monetize Facebook better. If I know more about you, then I can better target ads to you. And that's one of the ways that Facebook makes money. And I think that's where we're seeing this problem, because now it's so convoluted. Even people that want to set their privacy are confused now on who gets to see what and how much information is being given out. And so it's a very big mess for them right now.
Because just because Allison likes Star Wars and Al Jarreau doesn't necessarily mean that I wanted everybody. Oh, it's too late now. But I didn't want everybody to know that I like that. I mean, and I get that it's privacy. It's the internet. They don't really work well together. But wasn't Facebook started under the premise that you could control who could see things?
Yes, it was. And you and I should be friends on Facebook because I like the same things you like. So that wouldn't be a bad – I mean, a Star Wars fan, that's great. But the point is, you're absolutely right. I mean, when you think about the beginnings of Facebook, it started off as a college campus type of thing. And you actually had to have a college email address in order to even join. It had to end in .edu. So it's branched out and it's grown and it's more commercial than it used to be. And now it seems with 400 million users – everybody, or at least a good majority of people, at some point has had a Facebook profile or a Facebook presence.
So doesn't this start to kind of change the whole fundamental definition of what privacy is and your ability to decide whether or not you're going to share it? I mean, if you can get on some website that says, okay, nobody can see anything. Oh, wait, except that.
Right. Right. It's such a challenge right now. You know, I deal with so much email coming in from folks that are just really confused, and they feel like they have to use something like Facebook or other social networks because it's so ingrained in our culture. But, you know, one of the things that I think people really need to revisit is the term friends. What I tell people as a tip, I say, look, would you give this particular friend the keys to your house while you're away to maybe water the plants or take care of your animal? And I think that helps to really limit their thinking. I think the word friends is becoming so overly used that now we're like losing track as to what the intimacy really was about. And therefore, you probably wouldn't worry too much about what you're sharing online because they really are your true close-knit friends.
Right, the people that have 5,000 of them. But right. Speaking of friends, there is also a website that I was reading about the other day called FormSpring. What's this new place and who's on it?
Yeah, so formspring.me, it's this new website that's really focused more towards kids, it seems, and it's kind of just like came out of nowhere. Parents are still, they're going to be listening like right now, like, what? What's the name? I never heard of it. But they'll be shocked to find like 28 million or so people are like using this thing. Part of that notoriety, if you will, is not all good. I mean, one of the reasons why it's become really known is because there was a 17-year-old in New York named Alexis Pilkington who actually committed suicide, and they are saying many of the things that were on this particular site they think had something to do with how she was feeling about herself and further, you know, committing suicide.
Because from what I understand, it's not a very friendly place.
No, it's not. It's a place. See, here's the thing. It's a place where people can make comments about you, you know, anonymously. And so think of how maybe you used to be ridiculed or maybe teased in school. And, you know, typically that had to happen face to face, or at least you heard about it through the rumor mill. Well, now remove the physical interaction of being seen and being visible, and you can imagine what kids may be saying about other kids because they can be anonymous about it.
I read something that some kids are actually changing their behaviors. There was a girl in some article who said people had said bad things about a pair of leggings, so she stopped wearing them. I mean, is this a little sinister?
It's all about who uses it and how they use it. Mm-hmm. In this case, with this particular site, you can send someone a message or a question or a comment, but that user, that person that receives that, that information is still private until that person decides to reply to that comment or question. Does it get published to the public? So it's kind of weird, right? Because you're like, well, wait, if kids are feeling bad about certain things being said about them, why would they reply to them so that the rest of the world could see what the comment was?
Right.
Totally guessing here, but I do know as kids today growing up, we have to really be educating our kids more on being digital citizens, because whether it's this site or another one, this type of activity is consistently happening online.
Mario Armstrong is a technology commentator and host of the Digital Cafe on member station WYPR. And you can follow his tech blog at marioarmstrong.com. He joined us from Baltimore, Maryland. Thanks a lot, Mario.
Thank you, Allison. Be safe out there.
That's our program for today. I'm Allison Keyes, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
A website called Lala.com is a popular music site that allows users to download or stream their favorite songs. Apple bought it last December and then decided to close it at the end of this month. It's not clear why, but there's speculation Apple is developing a similar service. Lala had become a valuable tool for other music sites, and its shutdown is having reverberations, as Lara Pellegrinelli reports from New York.
Lala is easy to love. It costs 89 cents per download, as opposed to the dollar you'd spend on iTunes. To stream a song and add it to your library without downloading it, the price is a cool dime. And if you want to preview a track, you can listen to it once, all the way through, legally and for free.
So I'm looking for a song on the Prince album, 1999.
When you do a Google search, you often get the song you want with its own handy play button. Simply click it, and there's the song. You don't even have to go to Lala to stream its music, so it's become immensely popular, especially with other companies' music websites.
When they did get to the streaming model of the click-to-stream, it was exactly what we had hoped to have on our website as it is.
Reverend Moose is the editor-in-chief of the CMJ New Music Report, which compiles airplay charts for college radio. Its charts use Lala play buttons. Without having to leave CMJ's pages, users can explore anything they're reading about, at least for now.
A lot of what benefits our users is not going and saying, I wonder what Weezer sounds like. People know what Weezer sound like. So it's really about what does this band that's getting play in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, what do they sound like? Because I see that they're creating some type of buzz. And from an A&R point of view, from a discovery point of view, it's an invaluable asset.
Because Lala built relationships with independent distributors and not just the big music labels, anyone can track down one of those Murfreesboro's bands, like Self. Another place that'll have to figure out what to do without Lala is New York's Le Poisson Rouge, a performing arts space that presents world music, jazz, classical, and indie rock. Justin Cantor is one of its founders.
Because of the wide variety of music we have, it's really important that our website can clearly define each artist and what they're about. And Lala was actually a really great, easy way of us to be able to do that.
LPR has play buttons in its calendar listings, so people can listen ahead of time and see if they want to buy a ticket. Videos from YouTube and Vimeo will have to suffice until LPR sorts out other options. Or the industry does it for them.
I don't think we've heard the last of Lala. I don't know exactly what Apple is intending to do, but there's no doubt about the fact that streaming music is the way of the future, and I think eventually MP3s are going to become the same thing that 8-tracks were.
If Apple turns its attention to streaming rather than selling downloads, the MP3 could go the way of the 8-track. Then the Coldplay song and the iPod ads will finally make sense. I used to rule the world. For NPR News, I'm Lara Pellegrinelli in New York.
This week, Marine Sergeant Jason Grable got the ride of a lifetime in a vintage P-51 Mustang fighter. When the snub-nosed, jaunty plane rumbled to a stop on the tarmac at the Frederick Municipal Airport, about 50 miles north of Washington, D.C., Sergeant Grable told his pilot, Chris Baranoskis.
Oh, that was great. Great job. That was fantastic. Thank you. Thank you. My pleasure. That was too cool.
Sergeant Grable loves history, and riding in that Mustang gave him a new appreciation for the young flyboys of World War II who dared the skies in those planes which now look so cramped and fragile.
That seat isn't as good a cushion as you probably would find on your local Holiday Inn for to lay your head on.
Yeah.
So for those guys to fly and fight for 8 hours took an incredible amount of endurance and stamina.
Sergeant Grable is a wounded veteran. He was stationed at the Pentagon on September 11, 2001, and still struggles with post-traumatic stress disorder after bouts of alcoholism, depression, and other afflictions.
And I'd be fair to say you've had some rough years.
Yes, sir. Hadn't been easy, but you do what you have to do. There's plenty of guys out here that have done more than me.
Well, how are you doing now?
Hanging in. It's every day, day by day. This was a good day.
Well, that's why we're here, to get these guys a day that they can take their mind off of things and do something different and get out and enjoy it.
Yeah, it's a great day.
Sergeant Grable got his ride as part of the Wounded Warrior Project, an organization that helps veterans who've suffered wounds in service pick up their lives, a range of programs, some simple fun and entertainment like today. A small air corps has gathered on the airfield, both modern and vintage aircraft, including a World War II-era B-25 bomber that's been named Panchito, and that Mustang with glamorous gal airbrushed just behind the prop. We met three other wounded warriors, including Army Major Lisa Maddox, who's had multiple knee surgeries and got a ride in a 60s vintage Paris jet.
It's kind of a dream. I mean, I've always wanted to fly in a jet like this, so that's an amazing thing to be able to do. And you know, just being up in the air, it's kind of liberating. It's with the skill of these pilots and everything in their experience, it's pretty amazing.
Sergeant David Hatmaker served in both Afghanistan and Iraq before the vehicle in which he was riding ran over an improvised explosive device.
Got hurt out on a convoy, went out looking for IEDs, clearing the roads so other soldiers can come through without getting hurt. And we got hit, and my vehicle rolled over. I got my ankle halfway taken off. I was one of the lucky ones that actually made it out of the vehicle. The other guys didn't. And been dealing with that ever since.
How are you feeling now?
Feels good to come out and do something like this. It's nice to come out and be recognized for something that we did, and you know, be remembered for stuff that we did, not just for being a soldier.
Yeah.
what Ms. Maddox said, liberating to be up there?
Put a big old smile on my face from ear to ear. The best part about it was when he was pulling, I think he said we pulled about 6 G's. Face felt like Play-Doh when he was doing it. Just felt like everything was just dragging down the feet.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, he said about 5 or 6, something like that.
The IED that blew up airborne infantryman Neil Duncan's vehicle in Afghanistan in December 2005 broke his jaw, shattered many of his teeth, and sheared off both of his legs. As he sat on the grass at the edge of the tarmac, looking at sleek planes in the sky, his khaki shorts revealed artificial limbs that let him stand and walk.
It's amazing to see you getting around. How does it feel?
Great. I think being independent's important, and that independence was, you know, was gained by a lot of work and a lot of rehab and a lot of opportunity, you know. I'd be nowhere without opportunity, and it's like the Wounded Warrior Project has provided that for me. It's the same group of people that early on brought me out to learn to ski again, and then, you know, go hiking and do these different activities that, you know, Wounded Warrior.
You've done Mount Kilimanjaro, right?
Mm-hmm.
While Wounded Warriors helps give wounded vets the strength to stand on their own 2 feet, it also surrounds men and women who've shared the closeness of life in the service, a community of people to share their struggles. Army, Navy, Air Force veterans become close friends across all lines of service.
And we never met before today.
Just that brotherhood that you feel that you get in the military, you feel amongst us now. I mean, you don't get that in the civilian world. You know, you can walk up, make a friend, you know, in the civilian world, forget his name, and he'll forget your name. You go in the military and you serve time with these guys, especially out in Iraq and Afghan, and you create a brotherhood or friendship and a bond that stays with you for life.
We got to take a ride, too, and we're privileged to fly with a distinguished pilot.
Ice, that bogey's still behind you. I'm maneuvering for a shot.
Stay with him, Matt. Stay with him.
Not Tom Cruise. Someone who actually knows how to fly a plane. A lithe, athletic, silvery, retired Navy pilot who could look like Tom Cruise's taller, older brother and is a legend among airmen.
I'm Dale Snodgrass, retired Navy captain, and I am part of the Wounded Warrior flight team here and flying this MS-760 in support of the project.
And have you met Tom Cruise?
Actually, I have, yeah. I didn't really get to be too involved with the movie Top Gun, but I was the fighter pilot of the year that year, so it sort of became the snort here, the real guy kind of deal. So
yeah.
Anyway, it was fun.
What you are, the movie Top Gun aside, a legend in aviation circles.
Thank you.
What does this project mean to you?
It means a lot because, A, I'm a veteran, and when I'm flying with most of my friends that are flying with are all veterans. I'm an F-14 pilot. I have another Navy F-18 pilot, an F-16 pilot from the Air Force, and an F-15. And then we have our young JO,
junior officer,
who's flying the Mustang. So we treat him, he's the guy that has to go. He's our designated driver, et cetera. So, no, not really. But, I mean, he takes care of us. So we have a good time.
Yeah.
And but the project itself is something that we all had successful military careers, and we weren't hurt, but it's a way to sort of give back and put a sparkle in some of these wounded warriors' eyes. That's really what it's about, is to put a smile and a sparkle in the eye and give them a tremendous visceral experience that hopefully will, and you know, keep them, something they'll always look back and go, wow, that was cool.
We're supposed to fly with you, you know.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
We're going to be in a 6-ship flight.
Yeah.
We're going to be flying in close formation with the B-25. The B-25 is going to take off, then the Mustang will take off, then we'll do a formation takeoff with Jerry Kirby, my wingman. You're going to be flying next to airplanes that are about as close as we are right now.
Forgive me, you're going to have to beep this. That sounds fantastic.
So we're going to do that.
By the way, the flying name that Captain Snodgrass's fellow pilots hung on him during training is Snort. I can't really tell you why. But you're hearing the whine of an MS-760 Paris jet as it comes alive. Canopy open, wind blowing back from an Albatross bomber and the lumbering B-25 ahead of us in line for takeoff.
Pantheater, all aircraft are ready to go.
We fly in formation, old and modern aircraft, retired and active service people. Planes are close enough for a frog to leap across their wings, if we weren't flying so high and fast. Ponchito, the old bomber, is a moving sight in the air. Hard to believe that not so long ago, 19 and 20-year-olds would crawl into a craft with such a thin skin, glassy gun turrets that looked like they could be shattered by a baseball bat. We peel off.
Mustang 4, I'm going to take a spin to the right and try to get back behind Panchito.
Roger.
Neil Duncan looks above and below and snaps photos and shares stories with Snort. He pulls our jet up toward the clouds and rolls our plane over toward the right. We feel the force of several G's against our bodies while our eyes fill with amazing sights of the blue sky and green fields all around. When Captain Snodgrass brings our heavy jet in for a landing, his touch is so light and exacting, has all the force of a feather duvet plopping on a bed.
You put this plane down like you're kissing a baby.
The day in the sky, of course, is just a way of opening a window of hope for vets in the Wounded Warrior program. Spokesman John Sullivan hopes that the programs they have to assist veterans will drive down an alarming statistic. Over 300 service members committed suicide last year.
That's extraordinary. So an event like this can help put people in touch with each other.
Absolutely. And that's a big part of Wounded Warrior Project. If you look at our logo, it's the iconic battlefield image of a warrior carrying his comrade off the battlefield. We envision Wounded Warrior Project, our organization, being the warrior on the bottom at first. When a warrior first gets injured, we're there to help them get back on their feet. But it's our mission to honor and empower wounded warriors, and eventually it's our vision that the warrior on top becomes the warrior on the bottom. And that's what we hope to accomplish.
Our piece on the Wounded Warrior Project was produced by Ned Wharton and Gemma Waters with help from Jonathan Rappaport. You can see pictures of the vets in the vintage aircraft on our website, npr.org. And tomorrow on NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday, listen for a profile of Captain Juan Guerrero, competing for the decathlon in this weekend's Warrior Games for Wounded Service Members in Colorado Springs. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rebecca Roberts in Washington. Leon Hansen is away. BP engineers were on the verge of a breakthrough this morning in their effort to stop the leaking oil well in the Gulf of Mexico. But yet another mishap has set them back. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren is in Cocodrie, Louisiana, and she joins us with an update. Hey, Elizabeth.
Hello.
What's the latest?
Well, BP engineers had managed to set up a new pipe that's about a mile long, and the oil had started to flow through that new pipe up to the surface. Just moments later, a couple of the remote robots that they were using to take pictures of this operation crashed into each other, and they knocked the pipes apart again. This has set them back maybe 9 hours, but they think that it has shown them that this effort to fix the well is working, and so they hope to get it back up and going soon.
And what can you tell us about these huge oil plumes below the surface that scientists have found?
Well, actually, we're just now sitting outside of the research vessel that was on the water for more than 2 weeks, getting samples and mapping the ocean to see where these huge plumes of oil were. In fact, I just spoke with one of the researchers who talked to me about what he saw. He said the biggest one that they mapped was about 15 miles by 4 miles. So this is a huge plume of oil deep under the water. And they're also very deep plumes, hundreds of miles thick. So this is lots and lots of oil. And they saw several large plumes like this, and then other smaller plumes in the area where the spill was. They also saw oil on the surface of the water and just below the surface. The risk is that this could potentially harm marine life.
So given that there's still this much oil under the surface of the water, even if this tube starts to work, even if they're able to pump oil to the surface, what does that mean long term?
Well, it's still very early to say. The researchers that were out there, they've collected lots of information. They say that they saw surprisingly little dead marine life. They did see, however, lots and lots of dead jellyfish. So the jellyfish are getting hit hard by this. It's not clear yet whether some of the more precious species like bluefin tuna, great sharks, and some of the other amazing creatures that do live out there in the deep Gulf will be hurt by this spill. They still don't know.
And how much activity are you able to see?
Well, it was very interesting. We saw them packing up various samples that they had pulled from the bottom of from the seafloor, 100 feet under the surface of the water. So these are basically containers. Something looks a little bit like what you would drink lemonade out of, and instead of that, it's full of some dark brown substance, which is basically the matter at the bottom of the sea. They can use this to see how much oil was actually at the bottom of the sea. In fact, they've found that there wasn't as much as some people thought there might be. Much of the oil seems to be stuck instead in the water column.
NPR's Elizabeth Shogren in Cocodrie, Louisiana. Thanks, Elizabeth.
Thank you.